Welcome back to How to Be Queer. This is Chris.
And this is Kellum. And today we're talking with Reagan, the executive director of the Archive. And this is part three of our four-part Pride series.
Happy Pride!
Happy Pride! Yeah. That was great vocals.
Such great vocals. Yay! That's like the most singing I've done since I started testosterone.
Good for you.
Thank you.
My name is Reagan Swanson. I use she, her as my pronouns, and I am the executive director at the Archives, Canada's LGBTQ2+ archive. I am a student of archives and records management, and I'm working on my PhD right now in archives and history degree. Looking at how communities, especially communities in Canada's north, create community archives to kind of cement their identity and look at how communities use archival collections to talk about and explore their identities. And at the Archives, as executive director, I'm responsible for a lot of the day-to-day management of keeping the place running and making sure that we are collecting the very best stuff that Canada has to offer.
So is the Archives, it's a physical library as well as, is it virtual as well?
So we have a physical collection that is made up of four parts. So there's a library collection, which is reference only. We've got an archival collection, which is hundreds and hundreds of banker boxes filled with paper, photographs, stuff like that. Then we have reference material, which is that people use to kind of, you know, look through old newspapers, stuff like that, that's been published. And then we have an artifact and artwork collection. So we've got all of that in a physical location in Toronto. And then we have been working for the last couple of years of making sure that we have digital exhibits online and give as much access to folks outside of Toronto as possible. So creating digital exhibits, making sure our catalog is available online, trying to make it as accessible as possible, considering it's really hard to do when you're a paper-based kind of organization.
Is anybody able to access, like if someone were to come to the library, they like anybody can come in?
Oh yeah, we have public access for everybody. You know, we get students, we get media, we get lots of journalists, especially ones that are like, I've never heard of this before. And it's like, well, here's five banker boxes about it. We are open to anybody. You know, it's hard because we have a physical location. It's not like we can distribute stuff around. So we do offer the ability to like request documents be scanned and stuff like that, sometimes at a cost, so that people who are outside of Toronto can still access material and get copies of it.
So as we've chatted, the archive is home to hundreds and hundreds of documents. And so I'm wondering, in those documents, what was going on in Toronto in 1969, because we've chatted a little bit about Stonewall a few weeks ago, and we are kind of making our way through the histories, but I'm wondering if we could go back, what was going on in Toronto in 1969 or around that time? Did we have something like the Stonewall Uprising here in Canada?
Not in 69. So 1969 was the very partial decriminalization of homosexuality by the Trudeau the First government. So, you know, it was in the news and it was being talked about. But Toronto in 1969 is really interesting because it is when the Toronto Homophile Association was founded at the University of Toronto. And that was the very first homophile association at a Canadian university. And is still today one of the oldest, or if not, I'm pretty sure it is the oldest LGBTQ2+ organization in all of Canada. So that was 1969 in Canada. That was the very first kind of movement that folks were seeing at a really organized level.
Wow. And so what was the homophile? Was that a group of people? Was it started at the university?
It was founded by both students and folks that had employment of some kind at the University of Toronto.
Okay.
One of the founders was actually fired from his position at the University of Toronto. The Homophile Association was made up of a group of students primarily, and a few people who held positions as well. So it was really the very first kind of signs of queer organizing at any level, really, at least openly in that kind of way.
That was at U of T.
Yeah.
Now, for those of our listeners who aren't in Toronto, we know that U of T and the Village as it is today, there is a bit of a distance, but it's not that far away. So how exactly did the Village become known as the Gay Village in Toronto?
Neighborhoods develop in very specific ways. And usually it's about communities finding each other. The Village in Toronto was a place where community members were coming from across Canada to find each other. And that's really what the Village was about. It was a place where folks could be with other people in their community. You know, that's the one thing that we talk about a lot is finding your community. It's not a community that you're necessarily born into. It's you have to find your people. And so the Village was part of that. It was people coming, trying to find their people and making their own little space where they could go to restaurants, go to bars, go to baths, all that kind of stuff. So it's really about finding space for each other and finding each other.
So you talked a little bit about partial decriminalization. So what was the situation pre-1969 in Canada? What was it like?
So there's a couple of people that have written about this way more extensively, but than I could ever try to sum up. Like, there's whole books on this. Everything was criminalized prior to 1969, which included sex of any kind between two men, for example. In 1969, the very partial decriminalization meant that if you were over a certain age and you were two men and you were consenting and you were in private, it was no longer a criminal activity. So there was a lot of caveats, and really, you know, a lot of people did not feel any safer from the police. That's for sure. After decriminalization, there was still a lot of arrests that were made, a lot of people who felt entrapped by police in public places. There's a lot of work that's been done, especially in 2019, when there was the 50th anniversary, that talked about all of those caveats, that it wasn't really just like, okay, and now gay couples are legal and it's all good. No more problems with the police, no more problems with the government. Everything's hunky-dory. It was definitely not the case. And it was definitely not some magical piece of paper that went into law that changed everything. It changed some things, yes, but it did not make everything perfect.
So with regard to the Stonewall movement, I know that it was a lot of little things that led up to the one kind of watershed movement. I know that Stonewall is kind of infamous, and like, for queer history, a lot of people would point to that, especially like even in Canada. But do we have like a watershed movement, like a moment in Canadian history where it was like, okay, this is the beginning of, you know, queer rights here?
You know, I think it was partly 1969 was when you started to see those formal organizations start. So folks were here already, but getting organized, that was different. So you had folks who were like Glad Day, for example. So 1969, University of Toronto gets their stuff going. Gerald Moldenhauer, who was part of the University of Toronto Homophile Association, founds Glad Day in 1970, the next year, right? 1971, the Toronto Community Homophile Association of Toronto, longest name ever, and the Gay Alliance Towards Equality in Vancouver were both founded. So, you know, you're starting to see these things really go forward. And then 1971, you've got the We Demand protests that happened in Ottawa. So a lot of folks from Toronto got on a bus, went to Ottawa, first queer, well, really gay demonstration. There was like two women who were there. It was a group that went to protest in Parliament, on the steps of Parliament. So, you know, you keep getting these little moments. And, you know, 1971 was also a big year because the Body Politic was founded. I'm not sure if you've talked to folks about the Body Politic yet, but the magazine itself, you know, the very first issue talked about the We Demand protest and, you know, was handed out in front of the St. Charles Tavern and everything that the St. Charles did on Halloween. You know, here we are handing out flyer or this magazine on that night. So all these moments just kept piling up and piling up. I guess the closest thing that we would have in Toronto to that is the bathhouse raids and the protests that happened after. So when the bathhouse was raided, Operation Soap, the protests that came after it was more than just LGBTQ2+ folks. There was folks from the Black Toronto community and other groups that were there to stand up with LGBT folks who, you know, were tired of like what was happening with the police and how folks were treated the night of the raid. So I would say those ones, you have, you know, very, I would say, famous is maybe not the right word, but very iconic photos of folks walking down Toronto streets with the banners. You've got, you know, video of Chris Burchill standing on the top of a car shouting, "No more shit." I know it was a very big moment and it brought the community together in a big way.
So you mentioned the bathhouses. And so I'm wondering, did the bathhouses count as a private space? Because as you said, the law that partially decriminalized homosexuality, did it only have to do with like in someone's home or in a restaurant or in a bar? Because as you said, you know, everyone was looking for community spaces. So did those count as private spaces that people could be themselves?
So they were spaces where people could be themselves, but they were public spaces. There was four different bathhouses that were raided in Toronto that night in February. So you've got the Barracks, the Club, Richmond Street Health Emporium, and Roman Teeth Health and Recreation Spa. So, you know, these were businesses, right? They're not private home space. And so when the police came to break it up, you know, it was very much about arresting people and charging them. There was over 280 men that were arrested in that one night by over 200 police officers. It was very much coming out of a lot of history. Like, it's not like someone just decides, you know what, we're going to keep raiding bathhouses. There's a graph that I think Tom Hooper did about all the different bathhouse raids that have happened, because, you know, we're talking about it happening right up until 2000, like with Pussy Palace. Like, this isn't something that stopped in the 80s. Didn't stop in the 1980s after this giant protest happened. This is something that kept happening for another 20 years.
Even though the community knew that these spaces weren't private, they chose to go into them and say, we're here, we're queer.
Yeah.
We're going to take over, or, you know, we're going to go into these spaces and we're going to make them our own. Because correct me if I'm wrong, but the bathhouses were mostly for marginalized and LGBTQ+ folks, correct?
Yeah, it was mostly frequented by gay men. Thanks to the folks at Anti-69, I can give you a little bit more. So that's Tom Hooper, Gary Kinsman, and Karen Pearlston. They have a page that actually answers some of these questions more conservatively. Clause 7 of the criminal law made two provisions for buggery and gross indecency, and those weren't appealed. So instead, the bill added an exception to the clause that allowed individuals to commit these crimes under certain circumstances. They had to be between two adults, 21 years older, and a strict definition of private. So here's where that private public comes. So public was broadly defined. It included any instance where more than two people were present. So definitely not a math house. And so the definition of private could only include sexual acts behind bedroom doors. All other practices remain criminalized. Everything was tense in the 1970s. So, you know, you had all this big movement happening. You had all these organizations getting formed. You had community groups. You had the start of Pride in Toronto, which, you know, was basically meeting at Henlon's Park for a picnic. All these things were kind of coming up. And then in 1977, there was the sexual assault and murder of a shoeshine boy by several men in a Yonge Street massage parlor. And that provoked a huge amount of media coverage and like a lot of bad blood that was kind of simmering. The relationship with the police and the community was fraught, especially, you know, around, you know, this murder, around the other things that were happening, specifically about Gerald Hannon's article. That was also 1977, so that's probably why I'm thinking of it. There was a controversial article. It was Men Loving Boys Loving Men. And so this was a very controversial article, and it got Gerald Hannon, the author, it got Ken Popart and Ed Jackson all arrested on, I want to say, New Year's Eve. So what happened was the Body Politics offices were raided and searched, and material was seized. Where this intersects with the archives is those were our offices too. We shared an office with the Body Politic, and several boxes of archival information were taken by the police, and we wouldn't get them back for another 20 years. When the offices were raided and Hannon and Popart and Jackson were all arrested, you know, this started a huge, huge kind of discussion about free speech and censorship and the longstanding belief that, you know, gay men were pedophiles. You hear a lot of talk now about grooming and stuff like that. This was all conversations that were happening, and this article talked about those kind of relationships and how they existed for different people. And so the police were raiding their offices, they were arresting them, they were taking them to court. Everybody was acquitted. The province appealed, lost again. You know, there's a lot that was going on in terms of how the police were interacting with the community.
There were a bunch of different types of raids that were happening. So it wasn't just the bathhouses, for example. So I've read that Glad Day was raided as well. Do we have?
Oh, yeah. So Glad Day had a huge amount of trouble with their books, their products. When they were crossing the border, for example, getting seized by border security for having indecent material, like... So if you look in Gerald Moldenhauer's records, you can find these seizure records from the border, really, that, you know, talked about how stuff was didn't even make it to the store. Like, it wasn't even making it to the store. It was crossing the border and being seized there, for example, like on our backs. That was a big one that was getting seized. A lot of erotica. But it was also, you know, pamphlets and stuff like that. So it was really a mix of everything that was being taken or, you know, seized at the time. So, yeah, Glad Day definitely has that history as well of, you know, not knowing whether or not their stuff was going to be, you know, raided at any moment.
So were there any other types of raids that were happening? Like, what was it, mostly just like print and bathhouses?
Those are the ones I know of the most. Print was an easy target, but, you know, it's not just print. Like, there was video as well that were being seized. Yeah, I would say that it was mostly print media that could really be targeted. And the bathhouses were an easy target as well.
So other spaces like restaurants and bars, I know the village has changed quite a bit, even in the last 2 years, especially in the last 2 years. Are there any other spaces in what we know now as the village that were kind of like base camps for the community back then?
Oh, yeah. So places like bars. So like the St. Charles is an obvious historical marker. You know, we are, they're especially known for their Halloween show, harking back to the rules about dress and what is and is not appropriate or legal for folks to wear. Halloween presented an ultimate drag show at the St. Charles Tavern. And you can see the photos of the police lined up along with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of the public coming in to spectate, and whether or not the police was actually doing anything to protect the folks going into the St. Charles and the patrons, you know, that's, you know, we can say for sure that they weren't doing what they should have, because community groups started to form that would do night patrols and would help folks and, you know, do night walks. And we've got a bag of whistles that everybody was issued, you know, things like that. So the way that the police failed in those ways, the community found ways to make up for by creating groups that offered security.
Wow. I love to see it, but I also hate to see it. The fact that over the years, we've always had to be there for each other. I mean, would it hurt to have one public office that we could count on for support?
It's interesting because, you know, when we're talking about, I'm going to bring it back to archives because that's just what I do. You know, when we're talking about like who is safeguarding these stories, like, you know, the records that are about the St. Charles Tavern are going to be, if any records exist, their photographs are probably the exterior, probably City of Toronto, you know, maybe fire plan records, but they're not going to tell the story of like what it was like on Halloween night or what it was like to perform there or go to the bar there. So, you know, who was collecting that stuff? Well, we've been collecting it for 50 years, but who do you trust to keep those photographs, right? Mm. You know, the federal government was firing people for being gay and as part of the LGBT purge until the 1990s. Like, really, are we going to hand over community records to them? Like, they've got what, like 30 years of not firing people for being queer? Do we trust community records with the people who have been the oppressors?
It's the saying that's come out. I mean, I've heard it a lot more in the last few years is, you know, history books are written by the winners.
Yep.
What is it like to have a physical archive when the actual people who lived the lives didn't really get to experience everything? And I'm referencing specifically the AIDS epidemic, because we know about it mostly from the voices that came out in the States. We know that it impacted Canada. We know that it still impacts Canada with the partial blood ban lifting.
Very, very partial.
And so I'm wondering, you know, there's obviously people that are missing from our history books that we will never know their names. We feel the impact of their work that they did. Do you see that impact the work that you have at the archives?
Yes. Can I just do like a little 100% emoji?
Yeah.
It doesn't matter who's collecting. Within a community, there's always levels of privilege, right? So, you know, the most privileged people in the LGBTQ2+ community are the gay white cis men. And they have traditionally had the larger income, more positions of power. They've been able to have the time and energy to do things like found an archive. So, you know, our founding collections are pretty white and cis and pretty male dominated. And that is something that we contend with on a daily basis. You know, just because we're founded by members of the queer community doesn't mean that privilege and colonization and all of that don't factor in. Racism impacts all of our lives, whether or not we're, you know, benefiting from it or facing it every day. So, yeah. Definitely something we see all the time. We definitely see how the AIDS epidemic really impacted the archives. We had some of our volunteers pass. We had volunteers who had to stop working because they became caretakers. I should mention that the archives for the first almost 40 years was strictly volunteer run. So, you know, when they're doing this work, they're also doing everything like watching their friends die. So it's kind of a miracle that our organization survived, much like many of the LGBTQ2+ organizations at the time, because there was just such a loss in the community of people. And then everybody that was left to care for them. So, you know, half the people were being cared for, half the people were sick. Well, maybe not, I'm not talking like half, but like chunks of the people were sick, chunks of the people were caretaking. And you had all of this unknown partially kind of flowing around and all these rumors and speculation. And it's kind of, it's very much like just the pandemic that we went through, what, or are going through, I should say. Like, what is true, what is false? You've got rumors floating around, what will help, what won't, like, what is the actual cause? That takes an emotional toll on a community. And so it's not just the, you know, the fact that you lost all these people who died so young. It's also about all the, like, the trauma involved with losing entire communities. We benefited is not the right word, but we were lucky to receive donations of some of these people who passed. So we have their records. We have the records of people who worked to memorialize them. So who worked on AIDS monuments and stuff like that. So their presence is there, but it does create this weird gap in terms of generations in the LGBTQ2+ community, because everybody was so impacted. So you're seeing a lot of folks who lived through all of that and are here. They didn't really have a next generation to pass down their community organizing to. Like, it skipped almost a generation. And so, you know, you see these organizations now changing, including our own, because, you know, there wasn't a smooth transition between folks who started this in the 70s and people taking it over in the 90s. There was none of that transition. It was more skipping ahead to the 2000s when folks started other starting new organizations, maybe more queer, maybe more inclusive, and working that way through it. So
you say that, you know, because of the loss of maybe an entire generation, organizations that started a little bit later may have been a little bit more inclusive. How, especially the last 3 years, when so much of the conversations that I think our community is really reckoning with, especially the white queer community is reckoning with, how have you seen maybe the volunteers, maybe the interest in the archives, have you seen that shift at all to be a little bit more inclusive and diverse?
I would say that the younger generation is used to having more conversations about things like this. If you look at the organizations that were being founded in the 80s, like, they were along racial lines in a lot of cases. So you had ZAMI, you had Gay Asians in Toronto. You know, these were very insular groups that were very specific, and it's great mm-hmm. that they were able to find community within their community. But it does show that you kind of had everybody separated. And so, you know, I think now more those groups still exist in some form or another, informally or formally. But the way that a lot of younger folks approach it is maybe a little bit more of, like, from an inclusive lens, because we've been having these conversations longer, and, you know, each generation builds on the next. So you see those changes. But what organizations have to do, and what we've been reckoning with, is talking about the fact that our collection is pretty white, pretty cis, pretty men. So it's, you know, on our end, we did something. We created a historical inequity statement that talks about that, about how we collected, like collects like. So if you've got a group of men who are collecting, they're going to collect from their friends who are from their social circle. They're probably in the same economics like sphere. Mm-hmm. They have the same interests, and you just end up collecting a lot of the same thing. It's when you bring that diversity into a group that you have all those other voices. Every single museum, library, and archive in the world is dealing with the same thing. So we know we're not alone on that front. What's special about us is that, you know, the board has always been mostly queer, and most of the volunteers have been queer, trans, and, you know, we're calling from within the house. I guess would be the term. So, mm-hmm. you know, being open about that history, talking about that history, doing steps to like, what are we going to do about it now? Like, it's not enough. It's like saying a land acknowledgement. Like, it's not enough to just say a land acknowledgement. What are you going to do now? Like, it doesn't necessarily have to be like a giant land back sticker, though, you know, props to land back. But what are you going to do? And so what have we been doing is we did a review of our collection. We looked at 7%, which was like tens of thousands of individual items. And, you know, we looked, okay, well, who was the creator? Where was this made? What are the statistics around it? And so that's a report that will be coming out soon. And so we'll build our plan based on that. You know, we had to examine our past so that we could build what we want in the future. Like, we inherited this collection. And now what are we going to do with it? Are we going to make it what we want it to be? Just because things were always done a certain way doesn't mean that they should continue.
I love that answer so much. And I think it's something that we've heard quite a bit from the folks that we're talking to this month, and very much of a, what can we learn and what do we choose to take forward into the future? Because I think, especially now, we're all realizing that it's very much a choice in what we're taking with us. So I'm wondering, for you as the executive director, you've seen a lot of volunteers, you've seen a lot of staff, and you've seen a lot of community members over the years. How have you seen the community shift and change around things like Pride, having looked and studied these archives and in your own studies as well for your PhD? How have you seen the way that the community celebrates and the community remembers? Has it changed?
I would say a little bit. People still love an anniversary that's divisible by 5, you know, so they love to celebrate those milestones. But, you know, there's not a lot of organization. Like, we're going to hit 50 next year. We're the second organization in Canada that is LGBTQ2+ that will hit 50 years.
Wow.
Right? As I'm pretty sure I haven't missed anybody in there, but like, we're in the top 3 for sure. So, you know, when we're talking about celebrating those big events, you know, like, even the government of Canada, there is celebration grants that you can apply for, but your organization has to be 100 years old, you know? So like, you can't actually apply for an organization to celebrate a major anniversary unless it's like 100 years old. So, yeah. you know, you're not going to have any LGBTQG+ organizations applying for those grants because yeah. there are none that yeah. have been around for 100 years. So yes, there's a deep yearning to find community that continues on even now. The number of times people come to us and say, I've started the first trans group in my community. And we have to go, I'm sorry, but you know, there was one in the 80s. Here's the documents around it. I'm sorry that you couldn't have that information passed on to you and made available to you, but there was people before you and here's what they did. Having those conversations can be rough, but it can also be really great because it kind of shows that this has been around for a long time. The people who like to say that transness or non-binariness is new, and it's like, well, here's the documents from the 70s when they like created the first Canadian group. Like, I don't know how new you think like that is, but you know, they were professionally, like they were organizing before, you know, some of the like Black LGBTQ2 plus groups were. So it's really interesting to see people not know the history. I think it's out there more, but we still see a lot of lack of understanding of what previous generations have done and some of the challenges of previous generations. I think that kind of compounds older generations and sometimes like misunderstanding of understanding their own privilege, because what they went through is different from what people of our generation have gone through. So trying to balance those two point of views as people come in and do their research, you know, there is a lot that was not collected. There was a lot that was kind of forgotten, but the way that people now are researching, like it's definitely not just community anymore. And it's not just, you know, media when they need a profile of like somebody. Now it's larger institutions. We're doing a lot of loans. Like we've got material in the Canadian Museum of History and the Canadian Museum of Human Rights because nobody else collected this stuff, right? So now they want inclusive spaces when they haven't had them previously. And so they come to us and they ask for to borrow material. They ask to license photographs because people weren't collecting this. So I think the different types of people has changed over the years because it's now not just community or like researchers from universities that are using our collection. Now it's other museums. It's, you know, we're sending loans out to Berlin. We're sending loans to the States. We're having those conversations on a larger scale because people are interested now. And so it's balancing wanting to be able to share our stuff and get it seen and, you know, be able to be a part of people's exhibits, but also a little bit of resentment about having to be a grassroots organization that still is operated exclusively, like all of our operating funds are from community donations. So we don't have any government funding to operate. We get government funding occasionally for projects, you know, to hire somebody to do something. But, you know, we exist because the community still wants us to exist and because they pay for us to exist. And so the burden still continues to fall on LGBTQ2 plus folks to keep this history alive because no one else is interested in funding us. They just want our stuff so that their spaces can be more inclusive.
And if that isn't the flavor of the month, I don't know what is.
Yeah. Yeah. June. I have to say, I kind of hate June.
Yeah, me too now.
Yeah.
No, I usually take holidays the last week of June just to get out of the city a bit. We do a lot of we get a lot of requests for LGBTQ2 plus history for the month of June. And so we do those and we try to share the message that unless you're asking and supporting queer folks all year, please reevaluate what you're talking about, because just asking us to come in June is a little on the nose. And really, I have no problem saying that while you pay me to speak to your organization, because yeah. I'm going to use this money to go collect a bunch of weird trans porn that someone donated and have it digitized. So
I love that. I love that for us. I love that for the community. And I love that for you. Final question. As we've just now ripped on Pride a little bit, what would you say to someone who is attending Pride for the first time or learning about Pride for the first time this year?
I think those are two very different kind of groups of people. Attending Pride. So I grew up in a very small town. I grew up outside of a small town in like rural Manitoba. So like I did not see a Pride parade at all until I was in my 20s, probably. So, you know, there's a lot of folks that live in rural Canada that are in that same kind of space where they have not seen it before. And Toronto Pride is like legendary. It's kind of taking it for what it is, understanding the history of it and understanding that, you know, what it is now is not the same as what it was before. When you look at the pictures of the first Pride parade and their little placards, like walking up and down the sidewalks, like it's a very different experience. So understanding the history of how Pride has evolved and how it has become bigger and monetized and corporatized is an important part of understanding the way that LGBTQ2+ folks are or are not accepted into the community, and when they are accepted, how, in what ways. And one of the ways is Pride parades, because of how it has been marketed, in all honesty. If you're learning about Pride, as in the history of Pride for the first time, and like why it was important to be out there and be vocal and able to kind of like show your pride in a very public way, it's important to remember who couldn't do that because they were extremely marginalized by society, who didn't have the privilege to walk up and down that sidewalk and to talk about how those communities, like when were they accepted into Pride? And you know, it's I'm a historian at heart, so I will always say, like, well, how did we get here? But yeah, I would say just learn about how it started. And there's plenty of things online that you can find now. The Canadian Encyclopedia online has even started doing a lot more LGBTQ2+ resources, everything from bathhouse raids to, you know, the Brunswick Four, I think. Yeah, we didn't talk about the Brunswick Four, but yeah, people like the Brunswick Four. Yeah, it's about learning your history because you're a part of this community in a lot of cases. And if you're not a part of the community, then you are interacting with those members of this community on a daily basis, whether you know it or not. Mm-hmm. And it's an important part of Canadian history. And most people just don't care enough to look into it, or feel like it's not a part of their lives, when really it's impacted the way we live every day in this country. Like everybody, even if it is not necessarily directly applicable to you.
That's beautiful. I love that. Now, I suppose, is the time when we would like to usually give you a little bit of time to, you know, talk about anything that you didn't get to talk about. You know, if there's anything that you wanted to say and you didn't get a chance to, or if there's just something that is on your mind and you're just like, I need to say this. Anything at all.
I'll probably just do more of a plug for my organization.
Yeah.
So the archive collects anything and everything that is related to LGBTQ2+ life in Canada. So that's books, it's pamphlets, it's pornography, it is zines, it is music, it is movies, it is photographs, it is digital artwork, it is statues, though we don't have a ton of those. We have multiple locations where we store this stuff now because we've gotten so large. We are now one of the largest LGBTQ2+ archives in the world, probably second, maybe third. For our 50th anniversary, we've been trying to figure out how to celebrate. And it's weird because we don't have a lot of precedent of what an LGBTQ2+ organization looks like at 50. So it's going to be an interesting challenge to figure out how we want to celebrate this milestone when, you know, we're working in communities that are still facing so much oppression. And, you know, how do we celebrate, but at the same time, talk about where we haven't gotten yet? So that's a lot of what we're talking about. And hopefully we'll be able to do some celebrating with events and new collections and new exhibits online and stuff like that. So anybody is welcome to come do research at the archives. We're by appointment right now because of COVID, but If you're interested in looking up our collection, you just go onto our website and you can search it like you would the public library, type in your favorite word, see what comes up, and maybe you'll just find something that would be really interesting to take a look at.
So cool. Thank you so much. I'm just so glad that you had the time and space to chat with us. I love the archives. My close friends know how obsessed I am with them, and I can say without a doubt that I will be at the 50th event no matter what it is. I will be there, Chris will be there, and we can't wait to hype it up and to share it around. So thank you so much for speaking with us.
Yes, thank you so much for coming today.
Thank you for having me.